Welcome to the Innovation in Healthcare podcast, produced by Health Innovation Northeast and Northumbria, which supports the health and care system to accelerate innovation to improve people's health and the regional economy. In 2013, Health Innovation Northeast and Northumbria launched the Medicines Optimisation Programme, which aims to ensure patients get the best from their medicines to improve outcomes. As part of this work, the Medicine Safety Improvement Programme, or MedSIP, aims to reduce inappropriate high-dose opiate prescriptions for non-cancer pain and supports better management of chronic pain across the region. In this episode, Dr. Graham Sires, a GP and clinical lead for Northeast and Northumbria's Integrated Care Board, hosts a candid discussion with practitioners representing various points across the healthcare system, who deal with the complexities of persistent pain. They showcase some of the improvements already made and the challenges involved with treating pain across the healthcare system.
Welcome to our pain podcast, everyone. We have a group of people on the podcast today who are going to talk through some of their perspectives on pain. We've got a list of things we're probably going to work our way through, which we think would be useful to just get out there and talk. It's the first of a number of podcasts that we're hoping to do. I'll just come round and let people introduce themselves, I think. Helen, do you want to say hello?
Yeah, hi everybody. I'm Helen Seymour. I'm a pharmacist and I work with Health Innovation Northeast Northumbria on medicines optimisation issues, one of them being our national patient safety collaborative project around reducing use of opioids.
Excellent. And Ewan?
Hi there. Yes, Ewan Moll, another pharmacist by background. I'm the clinical director for medicines and pharmacy for the Northeast and Northumbria Integrated Care Board.
Okay. And Vicky?
Hi there, I'm Vicky Strassheim. I am a project manager at the Health Innovation Network, leading on the pain work stream, but my background's physiotherapy.
So hi, I'm Graham Sires. I'm a GP in Alnwick in Northumberland, and I've been involved in this through various aspects of working for the Integrated Care Board and work around prescribing. And I'm currently working for Health Innovation, Northeast Northumbria. So personal perspectives, really. The first thing we thought we would do is just get to know each other around what is it from pain that bothers you? Why is it an interest to you? What have you done in the past around pain and what's got you to where you are now? So I'll just go around in the order that we've just done the introduction so you know who's coming first. So Helen, should we start with you?
Yeah, go on, Graham. So from a professional perspective, it's part of my day job at the moment. So obviously got an interest in this, and actually as you delve through the history about how we've got to where we are and the change in the theories about why chronic pain is a problem and how it affects people, it's a fascinating subject. And then thinking about the question that we've posed ourselves, thinking from a personal perspective, thinking about myself when I have back pain, I know that paracetamol and ibuprofen is pretty rubbish. I do some yoga. I know that if I'm inactive, it gets bad. So I know how to self-modulate myself, and it's through exercise. And then thinking about wider family, I have a distant family member who's got fibromyalgia. She's on every opioid and every other drug you could possibly think about. But if she's busy doing stuff, looking after grandchildren, etc., she's absolutely fine. So, and that was something I observed before I ever heard about the biopsychosocial model. And then lastly, my husband's a surgeon, and for many, many years, he has banged on about how dreadful opioids are and refused to prescribe them in acute settings, has had patient complaints in the past, complaints from, say, A&E clinicians that he's not offering people respite from what they presented with because he sees the issues it causes for people with, say, chronic pancreatitis. So he's been an advocate for what we're trying to do. I don't know, yeah, for at least 20 years, which is really interesting when you start to look at our revised thinking about pain.
Okay. And from a professional point of view, your role, how do you see that sort of, what made you want to really push that side of things and influence that side of things?
I think I have two parts of my job, and one part of my working week is working for Health Innovation. And because of the specific national project that we're working on about reducing use of opioids in chronic pain, it's enabled me to give a significant part of my sort of thinking and reflection day to day about what we're doing here. And as I've networked with lots of different people across the system in Northeast Northumbria and wider through our national programme, it's given me the ability to start to what I call, we've in health innovation, we've created, I think, what I'd like to call the glue between what's going on in all sorts of pockets around our patch and elsewhere, and enabled us to encourage people to have conversations about their aspects of practice and share their expertise and things that have worked and things that haven't. And that's really pushing on what we call the whole systems model about thinking about any particular sort of problem and involving all different stakeholders.
Okay. Ewan, slightly different perspective from you. I know you've worked in various different organisations over the last 20 years, shall we say?
slightly more, but let's not go into how much.
Okay. And then your journey, I mean, you've looked at it from a primary care point of view, because I know you worked at Sunderland and there was very much that, but you've been in the mental health side of things as well. So just tell us a bit about your perspective on it.
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, during the period of time when there was sort of exponential growth in opioid prescribing in the sort of 2000s and 2010s, I was working as a clinical pharmacist for most of that. So I saw the rise in kind of new novel either opioid agents or delivery mechanisms for opioids, and was part of that system that very much medicalized the recognition of what pain is and the treatment of pain. So was very much in it at that time and worked on, you know, elderly care wards where you saw people getting, you know, quite high doses of tramadol and then falling over and fracturing hips and all sorts of things. Then when I moved into a commissioning role, and one of my responsibilities was to look at effectively the quality and the effectiveness of prescribing across all of Sunderland as a city. And one of the data points that stood out like a sore thumb was prescribing of opioids in Sunderland was higher than anywhere else in the Northeast, and the Northeast as a whole was higher than anywhere else in the country. So it got me thinking, well, we've got a problem here because opioids are bad. We're starting to recognize now opioids are bad. Opioids kill people. Opioids are not necessarily effective long term and so on. So I started on a journey at that point of how do we tackle and how do we address this? And there were several different aspects to that, one of which was engaging with the prescribers of the majority of the opioids, who were by and large general practitioners. And that kind of takes you so far, because that's a really important part of it. That takes you so far, but the more you get into this, the more you realize that actually the prescribing of the opioids is the end result of lots of other stuff that hasn't gone well up until that point, both in terms of healthcare, the overall management of people's pain for of whatever cause and diagnosis of pain, but also then much wider social factors relating to deprivation, relating to mental health, and then even at a broader level than that, cultural issues about how culturally we understand and medicalize conditions that aren't necessarily best treated from being medicalized. So our expectation that if we have a problem, we can take a pill and the problem will go away. So it's kind of grown from being basically looking at a single chart going, oh, hang on, we're at the wrong end of that, something must be wrong there, and trying to tackle that part of the problem, to growing out into going, actually, this is part of a much, much wider problem, and having to change my own understanding of and framing of the problem and what the solutions to that problem might be.
And I know your enthusiasm ended up with you on national radio, I think, talking about this as an issue. So how does that feel when you've taken something that's been like part of your profession and then it seems to go beyond that? You know, you're suddenly up there. What happened there? How did you end up doing that?
So one of the ways which we wanted to address this was we thought there was only so far we can get by trying to change the behavior of healthcare practitioners, because actually it's really difficult. If you're a GP and somebody comes in to see you in a great deal of pain and they're in tears and you know that there's not really much you can do, by far the easiest thing to do, by far the thing that the patient wants you to do, is to pull out the prescription pad and give you a medicine. And even if you know that's not necessarily the right thing to do, it's obviously the path of least resistance in a lot of these patients. And then also when you've got people who've been on these medicines for a long time, who in which the effectiveness is reduced over time, and at the same over the same period of time the dose has increased because the effectiveness is decreasing, so they take more and more and more and more, the prospect of saying to a patient in that situation, actually this isn't doing you any good anymore, we're going to take you off it, is something that is generally not received particularly well by patients for obvious reasons. And so we thought there was a really important piece to do around behaving, changing the behavior and the expectations of the public, both people who are taking these medicines, but also families and friends and people around people who are taking these medicines, because so often the side effects of the medicines themselves vastly outweigh the harm that was caused by the pain itself, and sometimes the individual doesn't recognize that. So we launched this campaign, which had quite a provocative title. It was called Painkillers Don't Exist, and that's deliberately provocative. The graphics around it were all quite stark, and it was designed to catch people's attention and really kind of grip them with a really difficult, hard-hitting message. And that captured, you know, the timing of it was quite helpful because there was more information coming out about opioid prescribing rates, lots happening in the States that we might talk about later, about recognition of an opioids epidemic. That led to quite a lot of media interest in our campaign and what we were doing and why Sunderland was at the sharp end of it and so on. So that led to all of that. And I have to say, that was, being on the 6 o'clock news is slightly terrifying. Thankfully, it was all kind of during COVID era, so I wasn't actually sitting on the red sofa with anybody. But in lots of ways, it was really, really heartening to see a much wider societal conversation, and that this wasn't just something debated within healthcare professionals. It was much, much broader than that. And I think that's where it needs to be.
And I think we'll come back to the Northeast, I think, in a little while, just to speak a bit more specifically about why we think this might be such an issue for us. Vic, I'm going to come to you. You've been quiet enough for long enough now, which is most uncharacteristic for you. Tell us a little bit about your role in this and how you've ended up where you are with all of this.
So I started working with the Academic Health Science Network, as was the Health Innovation Network, Northeast Northumbria, in 2018, and working on escape pain. And then I was asked, would you be interested in looking at the landscape of the MSK across the region, specifically at pain? And what we could say was, very similarly to what Ewan said, is that pain is the other side of the opioid problem, that it's one coin, but we're not managing pain very well. We don't, our understanding of pain is increasing and improving, and it's better in some places than others. And hence, you know, just to echo everything that Ewan said, there is the quick fix is a prescription, but we know that that doesn't necessarily work long term. So in my role, I've gone out and I've tried to map what's going on across the region, and there's some amazing things happening across the region, but it's not necessarily joined up yet. There is this wave of new information coming, a new way to run healthcare systems, this whole systems approach. And that's the thing with the whole systems approach. It's sort of fluid, running in between all the crevices, and we're not quite in all the crevices yet. So it's an exciting time to work. It's a bit of a mind boggle. You can see there's some amazing clinicians out there doing some amazing work, and we are really trying to celebrate them, hence the Feeling the Pain event in November, and that we've got a community of practice where we manage to get people to come and speak to us. But still, there's a big, you know, can we do more work around pain? Because people just don't understand pain. And I think because it is so complicated, there's so many influences of it. From a personal perspective, I'm a persistent pain sufferer. I got a back injury in just after the birth of my son, and he's now 17, nearly 18. So I have gone through that process, and it's been fascinating to reflect back and think, oh, right, that's what I did. That's what I was doing, and I was doing it wrong. When I think about, you know, after 12 weeks, I was still trying to get better, and actually probably that was the time when I should have been thinking differently. And I was at one point, I was given opioids, and it was the best 4 hours of my life. I had an acute episode of pain following a procedure, and for that 4 hours, I did not care about my life, that I had preschool children at home who needed feeding. I was just so far removed from any of my other problems. Mm-hmm. And it does make me wonder, and again, it's one aspect of this, is during that time, I didn't want to engage. I didn't feel the need to engage with any of the issues that I had. And as a physio, I don't understand the mechanisms of opioids, but is there a dissociative effect when you take an opioid? I'm just asking that question because I don't understand. I know I felt it like this. I really don't care at the minute, but this is lovely. I'm just floating away. And it gave me that time to be calm. So there's that aspect that I can see from other. It's been a really difficult journey. It's not an easy journey to manage your pain well, and I'm still learning it. So there's that aspect. I work clinically in a fatigue clinic, and there's a big correlation between fatigue and pain. And I have patients coming through who have got global pain. It's non-specific, it's spread everywhere, and I don't quite understand the mechanisms of it. And there is no test to say, oh, yes, this is what's going on. So you're left a little bit in the dark, and we're being asked, you know, there's all this confluence of influences of these directives to do. You must do this, and the, you know, the nice guidelines, and they all come together with all these comorbidities. It's a really confusing place for a clinician to be. And I think there's a lot of fear around maybe expressing that I'm not quite sure what to do here. I know this guideline says this guideline says that. I have this patient in front of me who's got these complex issues, who's got these resources, and in this short period of time I have to make a decision. And you can see what a difficult situation that is for healthcare professionals to be in. So it's just fascinating to be there and in this place. And I just hope that we can provide a space where people feel confident to say, I'm not quite sure. Can you give me a hand? How can I be talking about this? What should I be saying to a patient? So that's brilliant. Where I'm coming from.
I love the comment you made about something to do with filling in the cracks between the agencies and the you know, there's that kind of multi-agency thing. I probably just do a little bit of my perception of things, because I don't want to fall into the pattern of just being the interviewer. And, you know, that's not the idea on this podcast, I don't think. So my journey with this, I'm a GP, it's kind of, if you cut me, it'll say GP somewhere in the middle of me, I hope. But then I went into the musculoskeletal side of things. I became a GP with a special interest in MSK, and worked in an intermediate clinic. So I saw lots of people who were suffering persistent pain in that. And it struck me then that actually a lot of what these people needed was somebody to talk to and understand and be given time and not be given a prescription. But in the modern way in which we've ended up with medicine, we tend to actually give our medicines as a gift to try and acknowledge some empathy with somebody who is suffering from pain. Because in some respects, if we don't offer them something which is perceived to be of use in that respect, we're obviously not taking them seriously, you know. And yet you can take somebody seriously by simply talking to them and listening. And then through my other workings, I got much more involved in the prescribing side of things and learned about some of this strategic stuff about, you can look at data and you can see these graphs that show that there's this overuse of opioid, which seems to be much more pertinent in our region and our area and patches of our area. And surely that can't be right. And is that because we as practitioners are all behaving differently and actually we just need to learn to do things differently? Or does it reflect the communities and the experience and the lives of the people that live in our region? And for me, that just opens up this whole raft of questions. And then you look at this from so many different angles. So is it all to do with, it was told that we call it the wider determinants. I've heard a better word than that for it. It's called the building blocks of life. Okay. So if we get the building blocks correct, and that might be employment, it might be housing, it might be families and community and work and employability. But if we get that bit right, surely we would have less people that suffer persistent pain, because actually it's a way of being rather than necessarily a specific pathological thing. And then bringing everybody together from the different worlds, so social prescribing, mental health, movement, MSK, all of that, and working as a system to achieve that feels a much more tangible thing to try to influence than just focusing in, like Ewan was saying before. We used to think we just need to stop the prescribers prescribing and that would solve our problem. And actually, that's just a microcosm of it. So it's just of incredible interest. And then actually, I think meeting all of you over the last few years with similar ideas about how we should influence, but we all have a different take on it. And I think the more conversations you have in these forums and the more we work, hence the podcast, to try and spread some of that interest and influence and keep the momentum going for generating some change. Let's just focus in a little bit more on the Northeast again, just for a second. So it's an open question, really. What do people think about this issue about the Northeast being, are we badly done to because of this, or is it self-inflicted? Perish the thought, or what's it all about?
Can I answer that, Graham? Because yeah. I think that one of the questions that when there was a lot of media interest around the Painkillers Don't Exist campaign, one of the questions that always came up was, is this doctors' fault? Doctors have been prescribing these drugs for a long time. Is it their fault? And the answer was always, well, no, evidence changes over time. Understanding changes over time. There was a time when we thought this was the right thing to do. There was a time when we thought these were, if not necessarily relatively benign drugs, because I don't know that we ever thought that, but we thought that the benefits massively outweighed the harms in an awful lot of people. And we wanted to help people. That's why we go into the jobs that we do. So we gave them something that we thought was going to help them. And it turns out that as evidence has grown over the years, we've realized that's not the case. And actually the risks associated both in individual patients from taking these medicines for a long time, but also the risk to society, you know, people not able to work. And then you get into the other realm of these drugs actually get diverted and they get pushed out into wider society and all that sort of stuff. So we've ended up in this situation partly because of our geography in the Northeast. We've got a background of heavy industry. We had, you know, shipbuilding, mines, all that sort of stuff that led to a lot of industrial injuries. We also have greater levels of poverty and deprivation than lots of other parts of the country, and that definitely plays a role in it. Partly because there just is a link between deprivation and opioid use, but also because more people working in manual labour jobs and things like that. But more recently, we also have then the growth in higher rates of mental health problems, higher rates of obesity. All of these things all lead towards a great kind of melting pot of symptoms and conditions that people just suffer from that are all very interrelated, you know, be it pain, be it depression, anxiety, you know, cardiovascular disease, all sorts of things that are all very, very interrelated. So we've got a population that is not particularly well, is not particularly healthy, and suffers from that more proportionately to other areas of the country. But what I would say, something you mentioned, Graham, but since kind of meeting this group of people, you know, we've all probably evolved our thinking and our understanding on this. And the other thing is, we shouldn't underplay, one of the reasons we're talking about this in this way is because we know we've got a very long way to go with this, but we've also made massive progress over the last few years. And I've jotted down some figures that I wanted to quote just to kind of demonstrate that, because I think this is really important to recognise where we came from and where we are now. In October 2018, the number of patients on high-dose opioids in the Northeast and North Cumbria, so that's over 120 milligrams of morphine equivalent a day, the number of patients was 2.7 per 1,000. So 2.7 patients out of every 1,000 were on high-dose opioids in October 2018. That put us at the 98th centile. So we prescribe more opioids for our patients than 98% of the rest of the country. Now, the latest figures have us at 1.2. per 1,000, and that puts us at the 78th centile. So we've cut it by more than half, and we've moved down from 98th highest prescriber to 78th highest prescriber. Now, given the scale of our population, given that we're a very big population, and some of those other factors that I mentioned about heavy industry and deprivation and all that other sort of stuff, that's massive progress. And I think sometimes we don't stop to pat ourselves on the back for the huge progress that we've made, and recognizing that in lots of ways we are leading the country with this stuff. We've still got a long way to go. We'd much rather not be 78th, but it's far better than being 98th. So I think we've got to recognize the progress that we've made and probably reflect upon why that has been successful, because that helps us to build towards what comes next, both with opioids but also across a range of other areas where we over medicalize things.
I'm thinking about the American situation, and we've all kind of looked at what's going on with a huge opioid epidemic which occurred across in America. And now there is a degree of blame culture going on there, I think, and there's some big lawsuits going on around the harms that accrued. And we always concern ourselves that we're a number of years just behind America. What do people think about that current situation over there, and are there parallels with what's happening with us, or are we doing things in a different way? Vic, you've got your hand up first, and then Helen can have a word as well. Go on.
I think there are some parallels, but we have a very different culture and healthcare system over here. I've worked in the States and it is very different. You know, it's very much, it's a capitalist country. It's driven on that consumerism. The majority of people have health insurance. It's a very different culture. Whereas here, I have tried to get my head around this, but we are the NHS is a socialist construct. It is nationally driven, but we do sit in a capitalist culture. But there's a limit to that. You know, we nice guidelines, it's evidence-based. So I think we can see a direction that we could head in. I think the US has done us a great favour. We can see how bad it can get. I'm very optimistic that we can turn the ship before we get to that point. I think there's so many things we can learn from America. You know, they're teaching us an awful lot, not necessarily about how to do it, but maybe how not to do it in other lifestyle areas as well, things that may influence pain. So I think there are parallels, but we can't apply their situation to ours because we've got a different political setup, a different healthcare system that I think will put the barriers in place and protect us to some degree.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with what Vicky said about the cultural differences and the very different way in which healthcare is delivered. I think one of the key aspects has to be that we don't have, by and large, direct-to-consumer marketing of prescription drugs. And if you've delved into that rich seam of Netflix drama and novels around the Sackler family, et cetera, you'll see how pernicious that direct-to-consumer marketing was. And then the incentivization from the sales rep out to get their product being prescribed. And I think we don't have that direct to consumer marketing much. I think it does seep out some way in magazines for all sorts of things, not pain, not opioids, I think, though. But also, I think our sales force is regulated to it. I don't know if things have changed in America, but certainly the way in which drugs are marketed to prescribers, I think, is much more highly regulated by ABPI in this country, so that there aren't those financial incentives and that's changed an awful lot in my professional life from the days when you were wooed with being taken out for nice meals and you had lots of logoed bits and bobs around your desk that always just reminded you subconsciously about their product. So that's changed over time. So I think we haven't got that aspect. We don't have to fight with patients to say they want the new shiniest opioid pill, because people are by and large unaware about the plethora of different things other than what they've personally used or people they know have used. Obviously social media will have some part in that. I think some of this must go back to our way of, up until relatively recently, considering how we deliver healthcare and always wanting to respond and fix physical aspects of what people present to us. And that's still, I think, a predominant focus of what we do clinically, isn't it? And trying to change the mindset about it's all these, you call them the building blocks of life, Graham, have such huge influence in the way people can manage things like chronic pain. It's fairly new. I don't know whether that was taught to you in medical school Graham. I certainly didn't learn anything about actual people in my pharmacy degree.
No, I haven't learned about that until probably the last 5 years of my career, about and learning the importance of the links to local authorities and how we should be working with them so that we all have a shared responsibility for getting good outcomes for people, and thinking about people in the context of their communities and populations. In health, we think about patients, and actually patients are the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, we all know actually that the further down you can go to get that preventative agenda, but in, as is the want with us, the health services are at such a stage at the minute that we don't get the headroom, because we're just dealing with what comes in front, with the direct need of what's in front of us. So yeah, it kind of goes on into the biopsychosocial model of pain, doesn't it? I mean, is that a new word? What do we all think about? Because we talk about it left, right, and centre. Oh, we must move away from the medical model of pain. We must do the biopsychosocial model. What do patients understand of that?
I think very little.
I think it's. I was just going to say that all that work that you initiated in Sunderland around the painkillers don't exist. I think very much that people view the health service as being able to fix a myriad of different issues that they've got, and are quite often surprised when the medical science, the medical profession, allied health professionals don't have all the answers. And there's lots of unknowns in here. And some of the things are terribly sorry. We can't make this 100% better. And you're going to have to learn to live with that. And that's really difficult for people to hear when they're in extreme pain.
I think you're right, Helen. Sorry. I think we're moving from a healthcare system that was very biomedical, very paternalistic. And isn't it lovely to be able to say, I can fix you? How nice does that feel? You know, to have that ability to make somebody feel better, but we now understand we can't. But the infrastructure isn't quite there yet. Society isn't, in this country, isn't necessarily quite there yet to understand there's some responsibilities out there, and we have to gently let a patient know what's their responsibility and what isn't, and also understand what that patient's resources are, because they might not be able to take on that responsibility. It is really quite complicated to understand, to be in that, in this healthcare system, as information's flying at you. There's so much information there, and to try and navigate with that personalized care approach with that one person who's in front of you, you can understand why we have got to where we've got to.
I've just Googled when was the biopsychosocial term first used, and it's back in 1961. Somebody recognized all these different factors back then, and what it's taken us 60 years to start to frequently expect people to know about this when we're managing chronic pain.
And I think the other thing that's changed is how we speak to patients about their treatments, whether it's pain or anything else. We now talk about patients as partners in that. People have a valid opinion and decision to make, and what the best quality healthcare is when there's a sort of an equal therapeutic discussion between the clinician and the patient, where the clinician doesn't say, I know what's going to fix you, take two of these twice a day and you'll be fine, to one where somebody says, okay, there's a range of options, the evidence says this is what the side effects will be, this is the stuff you're not necessarily expecting to happen, this is what it will do for you, how does that fit with what you want from this treatment? And sometimes people don't really want to have that conversation. They want someone to make that decision for them and tell them that this is the thing that it's got to be. But I think we all, as citizens, have to move away from that and take more responsibility for ourselves in that sense as well. The old story about someone taking a diuretic for heart failure and saying, well, actually, I don't really want to take this anymore because I know I get breathless. But if I take this, then I can't get out of the house because I need to go for a wee every 15 minutes. And actually, my life means that I would rather be able to walk slowly to the shops and get a bit out of breath. But I'd still rather be able to do that than be stuck in the house. So we've got to get away from the paternalistic, we know best, clinician knows best, telling you what's the right thing to do.
As people in the system trying to influence some of those changes, I think we kind of have perceived the problem, we've analysed it, we've looked at all the different ways, touch points, if you like, about how we ended up in this situation. That change in behaviour that we would like either from society, can we teach it? Will it have to happen of its own accord? Is it an educational thing in my mind? I think some of it may be. Some of it is about modelling the behaviours that we would like to be seen and how do we influence those people working in services. It's almost like that when we talk about personalised care, there's a fascinating model of the consultation that you have between patients. It was a chap called Neighbour. He was a professor of GP in Edinburgh. And he said, part of what you do is you hand over to the patient. So you analyse what's going on, you come to an agreement in your head about what it is, and then actually in the end, you hand back. And you don't have that paternalistic element to what you do. But I think it's a real challenge to do it sometimes. Because of the level of expectation that there is on us, because of our wish to help, somehow it's about how do we use language, how do we do skills of consultations with people, or is it actually just getting people in front of the right people? So have we been trying to treat this with the wrong people for so long? Lots of rhetorical questions there, I guess. So for me, I think yes, we probably have, and it's a change of culture. And maybe for the last few minutes, what is it that we're going to do? How do we change culture?
Can I ask a question of you, Graham, in relation to that? Because we talk about not being paternalistic, not telling patients what they need to do, handing the decision over to them. But actually, when we're talking about opioids, that can cause really significant harm. So what do you do as a clinician when you're faced with a patient who says, I'm in loads of pain, I just want an opioid? And in your head, you're going, no, because that's going to do you harm and it's not going to do you any good. How does that fit with the not being paternalistic, because that still is being paternalistic.
Yeah, well, no, it's a really good point. I was chatting with somebody else from a pain clinic earlier today, and we were talking about NICE guidance, and that NICE guidance comes along, and actually you might say, this can't happen, that can't happen, that's not a treatment you could have. The evidence says you shouldn't have it. And yet, a lot of evidence is based on research where the greater proportion of people might not get benefit, but some small cohort does. And I've also learned about phenotypes around how people behave or respond to analgesia, and it reflects your genotype, no doubt. And actually true personalized care is probably to say to somebody, so we have this range of options open to us, and there are these drugs called opioids. You know, I could be perceived as a bad doctor for prescribing you these opioids because we get measured on how many we prescribe, and there are well-known harms, and you mustn't get stuck on them long-term, and we spend, you know. But actually, ultimately, the choice comes down to a well-informed person. And if somebody said to me, at this moment in time in my life, I would like you to try out these, I'm aware of all the risks and benefits, and I can say, well, if that's the path you'd like to take, we could try that. But I actually would like to have another discussion with you and we will see how you've got on. So for me, I'm never as black and white as that as a clinician. And people can criticize me for it sometimes, perhaps, because sometimes you do make decisions which you think from a medical perspective, I am exposing somebody to a risk here. But actually, really, only the person can judge. As long as you're giving them the information that they need, that decision, it's shared decision making, I guess. Maybe there are times when you have to say, do you know what? This really is stacked against you. I'm really worried about your respiratory depression. You're on all these other drugs. I can't justifiably say because I am perceiving too high a risk here. But there are thresholds. Does that answer what you were thinking, Ewan?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it also beautifully illustrates why clinicians will never be replaced by AI, because you can't, you know, there is no algorithm that will do that. Even machine learning won't take you to a point where that's a thought process you can go through. So I think that is really helpful, because guidelines, not tramlines. NICE will say what you can and can't do and what you should and shouldn't do, but that doesn't really translate into practice.
Can I ask a question, Graham?
Yes.
If you've got a patient in front of you who is in pain, is possibly from a less socially advantaged background and wants an opioid, what are the options do you have for that person at the moment, and what options would you want for that person in the future when it's ideal?
Really good question. So we've heard about things like social isolation can lead to people behaving in different ways and having poorer experiences. And maybe it's the skill of actually getting somebody to think that there might be another way forward to start with. So what language do I use to divert the person away from an expectation that we will solve their problem right now? And who else might be available to be a support to that person to take them in a slightly different direction? And so I think what you're getting at is that we've got social prescribers in primary care or health and lifestyle coaches or link workers. There's a whole gamut of them now. And where they work most effectively, I think, is where I know personally who that person is. I know they're down the corridor in a practice, and I can directly say to a patient, I think there's somebody else that might be worth talking to on this one. Their name is this. Is it all right if I give them your mobile phone number? They'll be in touch in the next few days to see what else we can do to try and solve some of the problems you've suggested to me. And I think we are getting better at that. I do suspect that if we can get that cohort of practitioners or workers that wrap around our patients to actually understand some of the issues that we're coming up against, we would be further forward as well. And that's about culture change, isn't it? And letting them see that they might have certain thresholds for picking up issues with patients where they can then see that they will do most good if they focus their conversations in a certain way.
Yeah. Oh, that is fascinating. Yeah, I completely agree.
I think it's coming. But I think it's, we yeah. probably need to be sort of drawing things to a close, I guess. We've ambled our way through lots of different topics. It will be interesting to see if our listeners think that we've covered enough here that's kind of focused enough. Or I don't know, has anybody got any thoughts about their experience of having done this podcast and where we need to go in the future?
Personally, it's really useful to sit and talk with people who are experts and just ask the daft question, if there is a daft question, because you sit there in your little room in front of your computer looking at all this information, and we've almost got information overload, and I don't know what to do with it. And I've got this question, and I've got that question, and how does that relate to me, and how does that relate to a patient, and how, with whatever hat I've got on at any one point in time. But sitting in this forum and just hearing you all talk, it's like, oh, I'm not the only one who's feeling that, which is really reassuring that, you know, we are in this world of just confusion, it sometimes it feels, and we need to choose a path. And there's a forum where we can ask questions. It's a really valuable forum.
I think we've had sort of quite a wide-ranging discussion about local issues, people's personal issues, professional approaches to things. I think it's been quite a nice scene setting about what the issue is, but also more importantly, I think about how our thinking about this has evolved over time from that very paternalistic medical approach to fixing a physical ill, to still coming through a journey, all of us, about learning new things about the evidence around this. But valid questions now about, we know some people know this, some people are acting on this new theory and having fantastic results at working with people and helping them live better lives with their chronic pain and reducing harmful effects from drugs that don't work. So I suppose, is it our aim in future podcasts to hear stories from different clinicians, different perhaps people with pain, to understand where they're coming from and what's been working in their experience, and think about how we can spread this message to all the people that touch people living with chronic pain, to improve the situation that we currently find ourselves in the Northeast, but also celebrating, Ewan, like you said, the great improvements that we have made, and we shouldn't beat ourselves all the time about how bad we are here, because we've improved things significantly for our population.
Yeah, I think when we reflect back on the start of this conversation, this problem seemed so vast. And when you're facing a problem like that, it can be overwhelming and you think, where do we start? Well, we started somewhere, and we started with some kind of discrete activities and we started to make some progress. But the single thing that's been most effective has been conversations like this, this group of people and others around us have had this sort of conversation a number of times, and it's evolved all of our thinking. And I've really enjoyed and appreciated hearing other people's perspectives, be they professionals with a different kind of clinical background or from a different part of the system, but also hearing patient stories. And that has all gone into influencing how I think about things, and how we think and how we act about things has ultimately influenced the system. And as Helen says, has improved the quality of care and hopefully the quality of outcomes for our patients. And I think that's something we can apply across lots of big problems in our society, as they can seem too vast to start with. You can look at it, and every time you take a step back and go, oh, well, it's actually also influenced by employment or housing or the economy. You can't fix those things. But you can do some things, and the things that you can do can have a really significant impact. So I think these conversations are really useful, and hopefully people listening to it will, in their own sphere of practice, find that inspiring to be able to not see something as overwhelming and to take their own chance to grasp whatever opportunities in front of them.
Thank you, everybody, for your contributions today. It's been a pleasure, as always, and look out for the next podcast as they come along. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Innovation in Healthcare podcast, produced by Health Innovation Northeast and Northumbria. If you'd like to find out more about how we are supporting pain management and opioid reduction, please visit healthinnovationnenc.org.uk/medicines-optimization. We will, of course, provide further links and resources in this episode's show notes. Thank you again for listening.